Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Bob Garfield with your regularly scheduled midweek OTM podcast. This weekend, in a series of tweets, President Trump both disclosed and scrapped secret talks in Camp David with the Taliban.
But the president canceled the secret summit after Thursday's suicide bombing at a Kabul checkpoint, killing a dozen people, including one U.S. soldier.
Democrats and some Republicans criticizing the White House for the time and place of the meeting, especially just days before 9/11.
Of course, the Taliban did not perpetrate 9/11, but they did offer safe haven in Afghanistan to Al-Qaeda, whose hijackers turned passenger airplanes into bombs in the most deadly act of terrorism on U.S. soil. A few weeks later, the United States invaded the Central Asian crossroads, whose history has been one of occupation.
Today we focus on Afghanistan, but the battle is broader. Every nation has a choice to make. In this conflict, there is no neutral ground. If any government sponsors the outlaws and killers of innocents, they have become outlaws and murderers themselves, and they will take that lonely path at their own peril.
The whole world understood, or almost the whole world. One country that was unclear about the U.S. mission and its motives was Afghanistan itself. According to a 2010 study by the International Council on Security and Development, during the height of fighting in Helmand and Kandahar, 92% of southern Afghan males there had never heard of 9/11. That staggering statistic caught the eye of Stars and Stripes reporter J.P. Lawrence, himself an Iraq War veteran. And to mark the anniversary of 9/11, last year he decided to conduct his own survey. We talked to him at the time about two questions he asked Afghans from different parts of the country.
One, do you know what the foreigners call 9/11? Do you know what it is? And two, do you know the connection between what the foreigners call 9/11 and the continued U.S. presence in Afghanistan? And what we found is quite a few people had no idea what 9/11 was. And some of the people who did know what 9/11 was were dubious that it actually occurred as it did. And a few of them also were dubious that even if it did occur as it did, that it had a connection to the continued U.S. presence in Afghanistan.
Now, you got various answers, none of which is necessarily surprising, but the scale and the scope of the confusion are. What are the narratives from the mouths of the Afghans you interviewed?
We tried to get people from both north and south, from both Kabul and rural areas. We found a rural farmer from Badakhshan, and he had no idea. We asked him why, and he said that, well, he just never used a TV in his life. He rarely uses the radio, and he mostly focuses on farming. So when he saw the U.S. soldiers coming through, he just assumed that they were there for the same reason the Russians came in 1979, which is to conquer the country.
On that very point, we should observe that long before 9/11, Afghan history, like Vietnam's, for example, was filled with invasions and subjugation by foreign oppressors. Most recently, for the whole of the 1980s, the Soviet Union. So there was plenty of room for here we go again.
Yes, I think that was one of the issues with the information campaign. There's always this trope of the rural Afghan who meets U.S. or NATO soldiers and thinks they're still the Russians. I've met quite a few veterans who have personally said that that has happened to them. And the coworker who worked on this piece with me, Afghan journalist Zubair Babakil, said that he has actually also had that similar experience.
And then there were those who spoke to who had indeed heard of 9/11, but were very skeptical about what actually took place.
Well, Bob, I heard quite a few conspiracy theories. There was a lawyer in Helmand who was entirely sure that it was all a setup to bring the U.S. into Afghanistan and to either take the minerals or to set up a Jewish or Christian state. a lot of the people holding these conspiracy theories that we talked to, they weren't rubes. They were educated people. There was a researcher, his name is Thomas Johnson. He's a professor now at the Naval Postgraduate School in California. And he did a survey of the U.S. information efforts in Afghanistan. And that was one of the things he found out. Because the U.S. had such difficulty in reaching the Afghan people and explaining the rationale for the war, a whole host of conspiracy theories just kind of festered within the Afghan populace.
Now, you don't need to be either a remote Afghan villager or an occupation-weary Kabul lawyer to be susceptible to propaganda, lies, and conspiracy theories if they fit snugly with your own experience or prejudices. And surely there was plenty of anti-Americanism and anti-Westernism there before the first U.S. soldier put his boots on the ground. So the seeds of Taliban conspiracy theories were planted in pretty fertile ground. What, though, was the Taliban telling people as the occupation began?
Much of the Afghan population is illiterate, but there's a strong oral tradition of poetry in Afghanistan. The Taliban capitalized on it, going from village to village, having either religious leaders or people on motorcycles explaining what the Americans were doing. They would also have night letters. They would post, say, a letter with a series of threats, maybe with a poem, maybe with an historical message on the door of the village elder. And the village elder would take the night letter and in the morning read it out loud to the various villagers, and people would explain what would it mean. During the Soviet resistance, one of the favorite memories of a lot of Afghans was when the Mujahideen, the religious resistance to the Soviets, they would put night letters all over the city, and everyone, after reading the night letters, shouted out their resistance to the Soviets. Many of the themes were similar. There are foreign invaders in Afghanistan. It is the religious duty of the Afghan people to resist these foreign invaders. There is a corrupt government installed by foreigners, and Afghans have a long and storied history of standing up to these foreign invaders. So when you have these themes that have been in the culture from the 1970s onwards, when those themes are marshaled again, even people who don't agree with the Taliban or don't like the Taliban, in principle, agree with many of those themes.
And meanwhile, the U.S. military was doing what?
One of the reasons I cite this Thomas Johnson book, and one of the reasons I think it's a really interesting survey of propaganda efforts, is that the author, while working for the Office of the Secretary of Defense, actually produced the first leaflets that were dropped into Afghanistan. The United States invested heavily in literally top-down messaging, dropping propaganda leaflets from the sky with various messages about why the United States was in Afghanistan. One of the failures of the U.S. messaging efforts was there was simply a lack of cultural awareness in the very beginnings of the war, putting the wrong language at the top of the propaganda leaflets, or putting an image of the Afghan flag but the stripes are turned the wrong way, or putting the holy words of the Quran superimposed on a dog. Meanwhile, the Taliban operated locally. They had a lot of latitude from their leaders to produce their own messaging, and they were able to speak what the local people wanted to hear. And one of the clearest examples of how the U.S. and Taliban messaging directly clashed was on the issues of civilian casualties. Civilian casualties, according to a 2011 RAND report, is one of the main issues that Taliban propaganda was able to win out against in terms of even neutral Afghans. There was another study about insider attacks, and what they found was even among allies of the United States, people who were working with U.S. and NATO soldiers on a day-to-day basis, a lot of them attributed civilian casualties to the United States that in all actuality were most likely the Taliban.
Clearly, the United States tried a messaging campaign, but what did we learn? What could have been done differently? What would you have done if you were in charge of psyops leading into the invasion to soften the ground of public opinion?
I think one of the interesting things in this story was kind of the perils of being culturally centric. Every year, we hear from Americans about where they were and how their lives have been changed by 9/11. And this year, we tried to flip the script and we tried to seek an Afghan perspective on 9/11. And I think there was a lot of interesting things that we learned when we tried to see things through an Afghan lens.
I want to ask you about the Afghan lens. If I understand you correctly, you're saying that 9/11, from our perspective, shocked us as a nation to our very core. But in Afghanistan, which has lived in war and occupation and many, many bombings and loss of innocent civilian life, it wasn't perceived as the historic tragedy that we see it as here.
Even among people aware of the historical impact of 9/11, a lot of Afghans are mourning their own tragedies. About 100,000 Afghans have died since 2001, according to a 2014 study by Brown University. Just in the first 6 months of this year, almost 1,700 Afghan civilians have died to various things, which is the deadliest period since the United Nations began tracking this period. One of the people kind of summed it up best is, for Afghans, every day is 9/11.
JP, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for having me, Bob.
J.P. Lawrence is a reporter for Stars and Stripes. He joined us from Kabul. That's it for this week's Pod Extra. See you Friday. I'm Bob Garfield.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper, with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.